afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us today, Bill?
Well, our sponsor
touch
this
the table, I can hear.
Oh, you mean...
Yeah, don't do that.
That doesn't sound good. Our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. You know, right now you can get a great deal on a John Deere tractor, mower, you name it. They've got them in stock up there, and they're ready to go. Get one before Christmas. They look good under a Christmas tree, by the way. Yeah, just drive it in the house, park it. Yeah.
I was going to let that slide, but I'm like, I don't know where you're having Christmas. But, well, I don't know. We might be having ours outdoors.
Yeah, you never know.
It might just be happening.
You don't know. So, yeah, go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call at 530-226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Okay, so just can you check and see if he's got somebody on the line for us? Just watched our engineer walk out the door. Ruh-roh. There's no one in the control room. Okay. So, anyway, our guest today, because I can actually do that part here. I just panicked a little bit when I saw him running away. Richard Kuby. Dr. Richard Kuby. He's the CEO and founder of Prairie Spine and Pain Institute, which initially sounds like, wait, what? It's kind of interesting. No, we just had a neighbor who had back surgery, so I guess I'm going to finally actually have something to talk to her about. He has served several years on the Coding and Reimbursement Task Force for the International Society for the Advancement of Spine Surgery. He is an internationally renowned fellowship-trained spine surgeon known for his advanced spine techniques. He's an expert in advanced spine treatments, including minimally invasive procedures and motion preservation techniques. Gosh, don't we wish everybody doing this kind of surgery was doing that. He's always seeking out new research and education to provide patients with cutting-edge treatments, operative and non-operative. He's delivered more than 100 international presentations, and he is the first one to have done quite a few procedures, and I'm not going to read them all for you, but they're really interesting. It's quite a list. I'm sure he'll tell us about it, but the topic today is bipartisan reform can prevent healthcare monopolization. And for that reason, those of us with good backs and bad backs, although we did a bunch of work outside yesterday. And
Don't talk
enough,
about that. I was just trying to get that out of my mind.
Oddly enough, we woke up this morning and we're like, we lifted a lot of really heavy stuff yesterday. So unfortunately, Dr. Kuby won't be able to help us over the phone, but would that he could. Maybe that could be your next cutting-edge invention there.
Yeah, teledoc without the contact.
Spine assistance over the phone. That would be spectacular. Today is December the 10th, 2023. You can always find us at wethepeopleradio.us. We let Bill do the .us part. Sometimes. Sometimes not. Sounds like someone else is having a malfunction with their car out front. All right, I hope whoever's listening in real time is okay, because apparently the world is spinning off its axis right now. You can't go off the axis this early. It's not even... Oh, it is 12 o'clock. It's 12:09. Oh, my gosh. So, oh, my gosh. We're having trouble with the phone now. Yeah. All right. So, let's see. We have our friend Debbie Bacigalupi, who is in Dubai at the COP23 conference. Ugh, would that I could play you the soul-crushing little song that is their theme song. I was actually going to use it in the show today, because the second half we're talking to Dr. Judith Curry, who is a climate scientist, and she's going to decode weather, climate, and this idiotic COP28 thing. But I'm not kidding you. That thing was absolutely just barfy. And I wanted to, let's see... Since I know nothing about spine surgery, actually, so that explains my distraction here. But I wanted to read to you these guys' I saw it on here. Yeah, cities are estimated to be responsible for 75% of the greenhouse gas emissions, and tackling climate change alongside urbanization, transportation, and built-in transport and built environment. I don't even know what that means. is key to meeting the Paris Agreement. Boo. So we're going to find out about that in the second hour. Dr. Kuby, sounds like you might be on the line.
I am.
Hey, yeah. There he is.
Third time was the charm. I heard a couple dial tones going on in there. Well, we already told everybody, you know, what we knew about spine surgery, and that was a long time ago, like several minutes ago. So it's all you now. What would you like to tell us? I know you wrote a great paper, and we have attached that here. You did that for Newsweek.
Sure. Well, I guess part of what we were going into in that article was just some of the reasons we see healthcare costs that are escalating, and it's, I think, apparent to most people that is a major challenge that we will have going into all of our futures, and that the amount of escalation, those costs, is just not really sustainable. I think I saw a study a couple of years ago that stated that the average millennial generation individual is going to spend about half their life earnings on healthcare.
Wow.
It's kind of crazy when you consider the government's going to take another 20, 30, 40% of your earnings in taxes, you know, between the government and your health care, you won't have anything left. And so that's obviously a problem. If we're going to be able to actually own the fruits of our labor, we've got to change something. And so that's why I have been pushing concepts of free markets for a long time, and certainly there are a lot of other individuals that have done so as well. And I think that's really the answer. If we want to control costs, we've got to have market forces playing their usual role and putting willing buyers and sellers together and having people engaged in search for value. And we really don't have that in the system as it is right now.
So. Yeah, so what would you change first? Like, how would you get us back to that?
Well, I mean, I guess if I had a magic wand, I'd eliminate the government completely in healthcare.
Wouldn't we all like that magic wand?
So, I mean, I think there really is no reason why, you know, the federal government should be involved in a third of the economy, healthcare. And I think anybody who looks at, you know, what are the two fastest rising cost items that we see in our current world, you know, healthcare and education, right? And neither of them are really fabulous products, considering the money that's being poured in, and those are probably the two largest sectors with the largest amount of governmental interference. And so I think, just as we were talking about site of service differentials in my Newsweek article, you know, there are a lot of unintended, I mean, I don't know, there are some people probably would say that some of this could be intended, you know, depending on whether how thick the tinfoil hat you're wearing might be, but realistically, you know, if you're just going to say it, at minimum, there's unintended consequences of some of these policies. So, as an example, with the site of service differential, when you send out bills in medicine, you list what site the service was performed at when you fill out those bills. And so, as an example, if I see a patient in my office, I have a certain site that I fill out. I'd be an 11, you know, since I'm an office. Now, if for some reason I'm bought out by a hospital and it becomes a hospital location, hospitals could basically perform the same exact service, but they're able to charge and collect sometimes 60, 80% more for the same exact service. And so, you know, I know there's concerns about, well, the hospitals have to provide services for X or Y or Z, and maybe, you know, you don't. And the reality is the hospitals get subsidies from the government. They get subsidies from other things. A lot of them are run as nonprofits. And they are able to actually charge for the whole different variety of the services that they have that are more complex. So I don't think that really holds water when you examine it in detail. And so I think it really boils down to, you know, if people were aware of where the money was going, if people had skin in the game where they had to actually engage, you know, you would see some of these things adjust and change as well. And I think that's a lot of it, just, you know, just basic free market concepts where you need to go out, you know, you need to be involved in some of the cost. You need to be involved and have skin in the game. It doesn't matter, you know, how much or how little, but when you try and create a system where people don't pay anything for it, it's no different than, you know, shipping off, you know, a couple dozen kids into a toy store with, you know, blank credit cards. Just take off, do what you want. I mean, you're going to have a lot of bills racked up that don't need to be there. You're going to have a lot of waste. You're going to have, as we see, a lot of administrative bloat in healthcare that really shouldn't have to exist. And in a market where people were actually having to compete, you would see people stripping a lot of that stuff out if there wasn't just more money to pay for more of it and more of it and more of it. Same thing that you see in education, right, where you've got thousands of administrators, you know, at the Harvards of the world. You know, why do you need, you know, an administrator for every 2 to 3 students at Harvard? What do they do, right?
And well, we learned about that in that hearing last week, I think.
Right. So I think it's just, there's just so much bloat there. And some of those things are part of the why healthcare just keeps going up. Because, you know, when there's just more dollars that the government or employers or the actual people writing their names on the fronts of the checks, as long as they're willing to continue writing their name there and sending that check off, there's really no motivation for the people receiving the check and writing their names on the backs of the checks. There's no motivation for them to curtail any of their gluttony, right? And so that's why we continue to see it skyrocket.
Well, and then we just keep making more and more and more rules, and I think anybody who is dealing with any kind of an ongoing medical thing is probably caught in that wrestling match between their doctor, the pharmacy, their insurance company, and their health. It seems like, you know, doctors spend all this time in medical school. They, you know, prescribe something, whether it's a procedure or a medication, and then somehow the government and the insurance company or both have decided, oh, you can't have that.
No, you don't need that.
Yeah. I don't know that they say you don't need it. They just, you can't have it.
Yeah, you're not covered for that. Do something different.
Yeah, and there's,
I mean, they're verging, I mean, just borderline practicing medicine the way they administer a lot of these insurance companies dictate to doctors.
A lot of it is done by regulation, and a lot of that, how much of this did you see really come on after Obamacare? Like, what kind of an increase in this kind of stuff?
I think there's a large portion that was there prior, and then there's other stuff that's there after. And so I think it's like a lot of things. I think the insurance industry is just emboldened over time. But when I think about things that have been there for a long time, the things like you're talking about, there's a lot of utilization of guidelines, right?
Yep.
And I think when you're talking about, you know, if a guideline is what it is a guideline, okay, you know, if you're going down the highway, that sign says 55 miles an hour, that's not like a guideline. It's not suggested that you stay under 55.
Exactly.
It's a rule, right? But they're using guidelines as rules. And so that's just unethical at face value, because if you use strict guidelines, that by definition removes any patient autonomy. And patient autonomy was the primary building block of modern bioethics or medical ethics, whatever you would want to call it, as it shook out of the Belmont Report, being part of the fallout of the whole Tuskegee fiasco, when the Department of Public Health was basically experimenting on, you know, poor Southern families, most of them African American, down in the South with that syphilis study that they were doing. It was just infamous. And that's kind of what it turns into now. And I see it not infrequently. Oh, well, I have to follow strict guidelines. So, well, you know, that's a it's an algorithm. It's not really treatment. Not everybody's the same. And the reality is if you're following a strict guideline, then the patient has no choice whatsoever. You're telling the patient, this is what you can and can't do, and they have no role in their own healthcare decision-making process. And so by utilizing strict guidelines, which most of them are way outdated, by the way, or they're super secret and you don't even know what they are or aren't, okay, and I mean, and I, you know, and as a member of our International Spine Society, I've been involved in creating some guidelines, but that's what they are. They are guidelines. They're something to help you discern what to do, but you know, your job as a physician is to utilize those guidelines, the medical literature you read, and your own personal experience to then practice the art of medicine in the best way you see fit for that particular individual.
And it isn't just out of things.
And that's going to be the rationing. So rationing will be how they control cost ultimately. As you say, you won't be able to have access to the service because realistically.
Hold that thought, Dr. Kuby. We're going to come right back. We've got to take a quick break here. We are coming back with Dr. Richard Kuby. You're listening to We the People Radio.
.us. She put the lime in the coconut. She drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut. She called a doctor, woke him up, and said, "Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take?" I said, "Doctor, to relieve this bellyache." I said, "Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take?" I said, "Doctor."
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my I am wise to leave them open for so long.
And we're back.
Hey, I want to, if we could, just back up a little bit. Here a while back, I listened to a interview with a hospital administrator, and he was saying that 70% of their billable income is non-collectible. I don't know if that's still a real number. Have you heard that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of funny ways that they do their accounting. And so so what's billable and what's collectible are two different things. And so, you know, you could use a lot of different words, and depending on your nomenclature, it really makes a difference. And so what a lot of people don't realize is where a lot of the money goes, which is, you know, just a quick wrap where I was going with the previous size, you know, all these administrators, that's where a lot of the money goes. You know, you've only seen the number of docs has doubled in the last 30 years. The number of administrators has gone up about 3,000% in the same amount of time. And so when you're talking about that billable versus collectible, there are a lot of people who make a lot of money off that number that sits in the middle, right? And so years ago, a lot of people just fell prey to this concept, I'm getting a 20% discount. That's great. You know, a 30% discount or 60% discount. People are always worried about what kind of discount am I getting versus what am I getting, right? So I could say, hey, you know, I'm giving you a hamburger, 80% off, it's $25. That better be one hell of a hamburger, right?
Yeah.
But people are buying that. And so what will happen is since you have brokers who can sometimes make money off of points saved, you've got third-party administrators, that there are different ways that different groups and the administrative part of things can make money off of that. So a lot of times, you know, it's like anything else. You go to somebody and say, hey, you know, this is going to cost $100, but you know what? I got it to you for $60 instead of $100. And so for doing that, I want 10. Okay, great. The broker helped me out. He saved me $40. Well, why wouldn't I give him $10? So then the broker gets some of that money. Then, you know, and then the third-party administrators, the Blues or whatever, they generate value by bringing people into networks, and then they may be able to get a further reduction. So, you know, a lot of times people are getting paid off of the spread, And so these numbers are somewhat artificially inflated because they're built, they're trying to build these fees. You know, if you really dig into how a lot of the people make their fees, a lot of the people make their fees based upon savings and spreads and not amounts of money and things like that that go into it. And so that's part of what they're talking about. So when they're saying it's not collectible, you know, they, a lot of times they'll make it sound like, well, we're just, you know, treating, you know, people who live under the railroad tracks, and it's like 70% of the people coming into our building never pay their bills. And that's just nonsense. It's not true really at all. You know, now there are obviously people that they will treat that they will never get paid what they would expect to collect. And what you expect to collect is a lot different than what you bill.
Right.
And oh, so okay. A lot of times those are very different. And then going, blending that into the Obamacare question earlier, then when you look at how that works, and this is something that has changed with Obamacare, why it's why we still see the prices going up. So they put in this ceiling that, you know, you, the margins were capped in the insurance industry. You know, and somebody who doesn't really think past step one or two in economics will look at this, oh, well, that's good, that's good. We're limiting the profits of the insurance companies. Or, you know, which, I mean, it's price controls. I don't believe in any of that anyway. Again, the market's always going to create the strongest forces for value rather than these other things. Because now you have a rule, well, what's going to happen? I'm not going to try and find a way to create value. I'm going to try and find myself a way around the rule. And so if I'm getting 15% of $1 million, I have a fiduciary responsibility as well as my own desire to make more money next year. Well, how do I do that? I got to generate more than $1 million. So the price has to go up.
Yeah,
I have to hire more administration. I got to do whatever I can to make the cost of healthcare go up so that I'm getting 15 points of an ever increasing number. And so it would be expected for this to kind of happen. So you start blending all those things together, then you get it to be harder and harder for a small independent practice, you know, who's very nimble and can kind of niche itself out. You start eliminating a lot of those. You have an increasing monopoly. Monopolies never lower prices because monopolies don't have to deliver value. And so this is why we start running into a lot of the healthcare problems that we've got now with how it's delivered. So, you know, things like direct primary care, that's a great first start. You know, get the quarterback working for the patient again instead of for the hospital administration.
Right.
That's a big plus. You know, so there are a lot of things like that that can help move along.
What about the conversion of, you know, we used to, I don't know, you know, I'm 62, so, I mean, when we were kids, we had a family doctor. We're lucky, we still do. And I think we only have a family doctor because he doesn't take insurance. He doesn't take insurance. You pay cash. If you want to submit it to your insurance, good for you. He's reasonably priced. He's very good at what he does. He spends the time because he's not under the gun with, you know, the insurance company demands. And he doesn't have to kowtow to their procedural things. But then you get to the pharmacy part, and nobody's getting out of that one. I mean, everybody's hamstrung by that. I saw it with VA, you know, just cut all of our veterans off their pain medication, just whoosh, all at one time. People have been on a controlled pain regime for 20 years, and now all of a sudden, boom, you're off. As a physician, that's stuff like that has just got to be absolutely, it's got to make you crazy.
Well, there's a lot of Q&As in there to unpack. I mean, you know, working backwards, I mean, I think we're creating some opioid pandemic and epidemic and stuff. You know, by doing some of those things, I mean, I see it happen all the time. People are afraid to prescribe the medicines, and they cut people off cold turkey, you know, and half the time it's a primary care doctor that I'm thinking, well, dude, you know, this guy came into your office with back pain, and you started him on Vicodin. They should have never been started on the Vicodin in the first place. But
there's always a lot of that. Absolutely.
That's what happens. And so now, okay, now I, now I'm nervous. I don't want to keep prescribing. So then they just cut them off cold turkey, or they do whatever, and now that patient's kind of languishing. Well, then let's back up. Why did that Vicodin prescription happen? I'm not saying this is always the case, but certainly, again, the force has kind of pushed somebody this way. So when you have not so much the insurance company that's jamming a lot of these docs, it's actually the hospitals. So when they work for a hospital system, they've got to generate and produce certain metrics. So the docs that I know that work for the hospitals, my own personal doc now who left that whole arena and is a direct primary care doctor now, I mean, he told me firsthand a variety of the ways that it works, but in general, you know, they've got to carry panels of 3,000, 4,000 patients.
Wow.
You have to anticipate that 1% of your patients are going to see you every day. And so when you're going to have, when you've got to see a patient every 12 to 15 minutes, and now you have to fill out all this electronic record stuff, and the average is about 7 minutes per patient that you're spending on documentation and records and electronic stuff. So that leaves you with really like 5-6 minutes left. So if you come into my office, and I'm a primary care doctor, and you've got complex diabetes and hypertension, and now you came in with back pain, you know what, back pain is not my forte. I'm just going to, you know, try and placate that as quickly as I can. Okay, I'm just going to give you pain medicine for that. Usually it goes away. Hopefully it'll go away, and that'll be fine. But I need to make sure you don't lose your foot because your diabetes is out of control and your blood sugar is 500. So, you know, they're kind of stuck doing that, or they're stuck saying, okay, well, I can't manage any of this stuff in 5 minutes, so I'm going to send you to the spine surgeon. Okay, I'm going to send you to an endocrinologist or a metabolic specialist because you've got your diabetes, and then you've got hypertension, maybe you've got high cholesterol. I'm going to send you to a cardiologist. So now you've got a primary care doctor who's very unsatisfied with his work or her work because now they're basically a triage individual, and they're not actually practicing any medicine. They're just
they're like
triaging people to specialists, which, again, now that costs more money too, right? So for every dollar spent in primary care in the United States, $13 is spent downstream. Well, there's a lot of money, right? And so, and that's another reason why the hospitals want to control those people is because it is a lot of downstream revenue. Where, by and large, you know, we know that 90% plus people will have some kind of back pain in their life, but almost none of those people are ever going to need a surgery or anything for it. It's something that's self-limited. A primary care doctor certainly holds enough knowledge to be able to put you on a little bit of anti-inflammatory and send you to physical therapy for a month, and 9 out of 10 of those people are going to be fine at the end of that month. But if they don't have the time to really sit and go through that and manage that and talk through that with a patient, they can't do it. And so that's the value of what the doctor that you're talking about you have. Like my doctor, who's a direct primary care doctor, I pay a monthly rate to him, and he takes care of anything and everything. Some months it may be nothing. Some months, you know, there may be a little more, you know, and it varies. But
I was going to ask you, what does direct primary care doctor mean? I was thinking it mean, I thought you meant that that's all he does is primary care. No, it's a
whole model.
Oh.
So one model is something, you know, concierge medicine people talk about.
Right.
And so you pay a fee, and the doctor has you as a patient, and then you pay. And that fee basically is no different than, like, say, a members-only jacket for those of us from the 80s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically just buys you a membership, and then you still pay a la carte for all the services you get from the doc. For direct primary care, those physicians for a membership will basically handle all of your medical problems. And so in that scenario, you know, they could basically, instead of a panel of 3,000 to 4,000, they could hold a panel of 700 to 800, generally make the same amount of money, sometimes even more, in their bottom line because, again, they're stripping all the administration out of it. They don't need a billing department. They don't need a collections department. The money is coming in, again, in a very, I guess, in an expected manner. You know,
sure, because
it's a
fee.
A lot of ebbs and flows. You're not having to borrow. You're not hitting lines of credit and paying the bank when there's shortfalls for a month. So it really evens it out and allows them to streamline their service and now provide that service. And so, And as such, now they're able to spend 45 minutes to an hour with a patient.
So
they're able to really dig in.
They're a fee for service, but they already know who their patients are because they pay a monthly. This is terrible to say. Well, I don't know if it's terrible. It's true. That's what we do with our dog.
it's like a prepay program.
Yeah, $60 a month or whatever it is, and then if I have to take him in for a checkup, the checkup's included. If he has to have surgery, it's like a 20% reduction off the fee or whatever because he's part of that program. Huh?
And I pay $70 a month, and Bill Fisher does all of my medical care, however much or however little that might be. He handles all of it. He'll even handle little procedural stuff. It's all wrapped in. So I had kind of a weird skin little lesion. He took a biopsy, sent it off. That was part of it. You know, I've had some other things where, hey, you know, and again, he's got the time where, hey, I'm going to take your scans and show them to a couple of other radiology friends and see what they have to think about it. You know, so your service and your quality are definitely better. And again, he is independent. So,
sure.
You know, I say this, you know, as a spine guy, you know, I have these conversations with people as well because I don't go to the hospital. I run my own facility. I do my own thing. And again, people are like, there's this sort of thought a lot of times of, well, if you don't, you know, there must be something wrong if you're not going to the hospital. Why wouldn't you go to the hospital? So, well, I don't know. Why would you want to go to a giant building full of sick and dying people to do an elective procedure? You know,
it's good to hear a doctor say that because we think that all the time out here. We just figure that's because we're stupid and we don't know what's going on in there. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with Dr. Richard Kuby. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. High part. Yeah, what is going on? Except for that. We could ace that out. But I'll tell you, when it comes to the medical stuff, Dr. Kuby, I think most people anymore are just grateful if they're not sick. Because as soon as something happens, they enter this labyrinth that seems to have, you know, no directions.
Well, yeah, and if
and no common sense.
You know, heaven forbid anything major happens to you. I mean, you could be facing bankruptcy just trying to get taken care of and getting through the medical system.
But what I hear more from people, other than the cost, actually, I don't hear so much about the cost anymore. But what I am hearing is access. Access is the problem.
Yeah, that's true.
I work with a fellow who's
been waiting months.
Well, you're not hearing as much about the cost, right? Because the rationing is going on.
Yeah.
And again, if you have a monopoly, you're not driven to provide the access. So again, like I say, it's like a lot of things. You know, so my practice, people have to choose me. I don't work for a hospital. I don't have 300 medical doctors that are all funneling all their spines to me, right? And so I'm beholden to you, and I've got to provide good service to you, or you will one-star me or two-star me, or you will tell your friends and family that, you know, that service is bad, and then my office is empty. You know, I don't have a $15 million year marketing budget like the local hospital might have to go out and find people, or have a giant building with 1 million square feet of commercial space that's, you know, obvious and everybody can see it from, you know, outer space practically. So it changes the dynamic because now I have to work for you, and that's why I like the idea of the direct primary care as well, because now that physician is working for me. They are trying to help. They are helping to navigate me through the system and help direct me to the best providers and those things, because that's part of the value. They're wanting to make sure that I feel value, because if I don't, I don't renew my membership, right? I'm gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, there is an incentive for them to make sure that I am happy. That same incentive does not really exist in the other world, because in the other world, i.e. when I work for the hospital, I'm having to please the hospital administration. And their success metrics aren't really always patient-centric. Their success, you've got people who are looking at bottom lines. And those bottom lines aren't really, you know, I mean, as long as the care is good enough, they're happy. They're not really ever trying to go above and beyond, because it's just not the way the model works.
Hmm. So,
and so that's why you'll see and hear a lot of the things you're talking about now. And again, you know, and again, I think most people still aren't paying for the care. So most people aren't going to be talking about the expense. But if you talk to employers who are self-funded and self-insured, they do still talk about the cost.
Yes.
Because those people are getting jammed, and when they're seeing increases in premiums of 8-9% pretty easily year on end, if you use the Stansure rule of 72, 9% a year, in 8 years you'll be spending double what you are today on health care. So if you're spending $30,000 a year for a family plan, it's 60. You know, by the time we hit 31, who the heck's going to be able to afford $60,000 for health care in their household?
Right,
so,
and then you have folks who wind up with cancer or something like that that requires really expensive medication,
exactly.
And if they are self-employed, that becomes immediately out of reach if they're not Medicare eligible.
Exactly right. They're just totally busted. And so, you know, there are different things. You know, like I said, you know, the direct primary care definitely helps. You know, if you're small, like my practice is, we use a health sharing type of group that, you know, we pay into, and the costs are shared between members, you know, in multiple states and regions and what have you. But, you know, it essentially has dropped our health care costs by probably 65-70%.
Wow.
And if you're a self-funded, self-insured group, there are a lot of free market options and strategies out there where you can find bundled payment models and other direct sourcing, you know, where groups like mine, folks like Keith Smith, and Surgery Center of Oklahoma City, and they really started this whole free market medical type of movement, you know, 10 years or better ago. And so that gives the employers an opportunity as well. I mean, I can just speak for Spine. I know when I look at the benefits receipts, when I'm actually able to get my hands on them, I save those folks on average $80,000 a case here. You know, now you're only going to have a spine surgery one in every 1,000 to 2,000 employees. But let's say you have 1,000 employees. If you have 1,000 employees, that's still probably a family business. There's still probably two or three people maybe who own that business. And so $80,000 is real money.
Yeah,
for that
okay.
One surgery. And that means now it's me and maybe my brother and sister sitting around and saying, hey, what are you going to do with your 30 grand this year? I mean, that's real money, and that's just spine. But when you extrapolate that to free market imaging, orthopedic, general orthopedic services, obstetrical and gynecological services, general surgery services, you're not paying $25,000 for a gallbladder, you're paying four. You know, those are the kind of things that make real impact, where you could probably, with 1,000 employees, start saving, you know, $1 million, $2 million a year. That's real impact. And a lot of these people who've gone in that direction, they've kept their company healthcare costs relatively flat over the last several years. And a lot of the reason is that. A lot of the reason, too, if you've got a direct primary care physician, you're actually getting in to see them. You know, people aren't reluctant to go see them. So you're also having these other interesting things that occur, like, you know, your usage of emergency room and prompt care services go down when there's direct primary care. Well, guess what? Those are really expensive services. now I'm actually getting health care, not sick care.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually not afraid to go to my doctor because I know the costs are already covered through direct primary care. It's there whether I use it or not. So now I am getting in. I am keeping my diabetes under control. I am keeping my hypertension under control. So now I'm not dealing with a diabetic foot ulcer. I'm not dealing with all the other constellation of health problems that come with
putting stuff off. Well, tell me this. Is this a... okay, so we've heard from many guests, and I know from a relative, actually. She completed her neuroscience degree at Texas Christian in like 3 years. She was headed for medical school and then looked at the cost of that versus how she was going to wind up probably as a hospitalist or something like that, not be able to pay her loans, and opted to be a PA. So, and we keep hearing that, the residency programs are going, you know, it used to be highly competitive, now not so highly competitive. So the next batch of physicians coming in, the people in the pipeline, is what you're talking about an attractive thing that you think will grow with the incoming group? Or do you think it will continue to wind out into the hospitalists who don't run private practice?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the challenge we have in medicine is it's not like you train any of us overnight.
So, takes a long time.
You know, I go and talk to kids in school, and I'm like, oh, huh? And it's like, I graduated from the 26th grade. You know, and that usually kind of catches them pretty well, you know, when you're talking to high school seniors in a science class, and you're like, yeah, 2 years from now, you'll be halfway there. and so it's not like you could really make us overnight. And so any path you go down makes it challenging, and there is nobody teaching any of us any economics, any business, any anything.
Right.
And the reality is if you're out in a private practice, you're on the board of directors for a multi-million dollar company. You know, it doesn't take a whole lot to generate a few million dollars in gross revenue a year with a couple of surgeons. You know, and people don't really think about it that way. But yeah, no, you are. You're either an owner or a CEO or just a director of a multi-million dollar corporation, and you have to think about a lot of things that you've never been trained to think about, how to deal with payroll and insurance and all these other different facets of your practice. And so it is going to be hard. And with there being so much dictated to you, that's why you see, I mean, physicians have the highest suicide rate of any profession in the United States. And a lot of that is because there's the autonomy issue. So even if you feel like you've got some control, you know, that, and that's why patient autonomy is so important, and that's where patient satisfaction comes from, is when they feel like they have the ability to have some control over their health care and some control over their future. The physicians are individuals too, and when so much is dictated to them by bureaucrats or guidelines or rules or whatever it might be,
sure,
then their satisfaction rate goes down substantially as well. And you start pairing all that together, especially when a lot of times the one size fits all doesn't really ever fit anybody. And you find yourself having to make decisions over whether do I toe the party line for hospital X, Y, or Z, or do I, lobby for this one patient over here, or this other patient over here, or this other patient over there. And, now you're having to determine, do I risk my financial livelihood and go along with it, or do I buck that and risk that for these patients that fall outside the typical or outside the normal? And that's a very onerous place to put people.
Yeah, that's a tough position.
The family physicians that I've talked to that have left, I'll just call it the cartel, and gone into direct primary care otherwise, I mean, you want to talk about the most liberated feeling people, because now they feel like they can actually control, how their patients get treated, how they deliver medicine. And I think if we can start pushing into more of those things, you will see a change. Because I just speak, for myself, when you talk about competitiveness and so forth. So, when I went into orthopedics, my fellow or residency director said there are 400 people that applied for the three spots that he had in orthopedics in his place. You know, so, I mean, I don't know, relatively competitive, right? I mean, we're all in med school already, you know, and so I don't know what it is now, right? But what I do know is that when I was in medical school, I mean, I was the first guy to go to college in my family, so I was different, but there were a lot of people, hey, yeah, I'm the third in my generation in my family to be a physician. I'm, you know, or we go, or my dad or my mom was a doctor, or my grandparents. I have three kids. None of them going into medicine. And in fact, I've coached them out of medicine because of some of these things. I mean, I happen to have my own independent thing going on, but frankly, I don't know how I would create it tomorrow if I had to, because the regulation is so difficult to go through, and the amount of expense that you would have to go to get started, it really is kind of prohibitive in many ways, you know, and I think that's by design. It's increasingly difficult and for an independent group to get out there, and if there's no independent groups, then there's no choice other than the big choice, right?
Sure.
And you're stuck. Even though you're not happy with what you're talking about, I don't have access and this really sucks, you're still there because that's the only choice you have.
So yeah, you don't have a choice.
Well, I see this always, this push with Medicare for all, and you know, that just takes everything you're saying, puts it on steroids, and blows the whole deal up, in my estimation.
Right. You like the VA? they do a great job, right?
Yeah, that works great.
When's the last time you gave the post office a 5-star review?
Yeah, let's not go there. Yeah, I mean, and you know, when it works great. Like, you know, I speak to a lot of people who are I deal with VA a lot, and in my real life, my real job, and there are a lot of people who have no problems whatsoever. But 9 times out of 10, those are people who go there for routine stuff, do not have any complicated ongoing care, and do not require any outside you know, outside referrals and all that kind of stuff. It's when you become sick, you know, or you have some, God forbid, you have something weird, you know, not something straight ahead, and you get something weird, and then all of a sudden you require them to spring into action. And a lot of times that's not really a gear.
Well, the reality is if that system worked, I wouldn't get calls from Canada for people trying to escape and get treatment.
Yep. Exactly.
I've had patients from Canada that, I mean, they tell me it took a year to get an MRI.
Yeah, and they can't pay cash.
I mean,
you can't escape from that. That's the other trick that people don't understand is
exactly
once that all happens, people say, well, you could just pay cash. No, you can't. It's against the law.
No, they won't. Yeah.
So we're down into the last 20 seconds here. So rather than cut you off unceremoniously, I thought I would tell you thank you for your time and your expertise. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
We have been chatting.
Anybody looking to learn more, Free Market Medical Association.
Oh, good. Okay.
Check it out. Look into it. That's, you know, I'm just one of many people who
Free Market Medical
involved,
Association.
You know, and I did not start that organization, but the Free Market Medical Association, the folks that are involved with that are really trying to change a lot of things.
We will refer to that, and thank you very much. We'll be right back next hour. We're talking to Dr. Judith Curry. Thank you, Dr. Kuby. You're listening to We the People Radio. US. Welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pappy Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Right now you can go up there and get a great deal on a John Deere tractor, a mower, a implement. They got everything in stock. Go up and see them. If they don't have it, they've got several other stores they can draw from and get it in there and get it in time for Christmas. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Never gets old, does it?
No.
Okay. So, we're going to shift gears. We were talking about medicine in the first hour. Now we're going to talk about weather and climate and COP28 that you might have been hearing about in the news. We're going to find out what that's about. I kind of know already, but I got to tell you, I just want a spoiler alert. I am not playing the theme song. I was tempted. I thought about doing it. But then I thought, oh, man, I'm going to make a lot of people throw up. That would be terrible.
It was so wholesome. It was.
I had diabetes by the time I got done listening to it, and then I couldn't play it anymore. So we're going to be chatting with Dr. Judith Curry. She's president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She's a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and prediction and predictability. Imagine that. Weather prediction and predictability. How handy. I wish she could come work here. She is a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. We've done a couple of shows with her, and I have listed those on the website. She had a terrific career until she, she got branded as a heretic.
Heretic.
That's a club we're proud to be in, and we have no skills, though, so we're not real heretics. We're armchair heretics. She's the real deal. She knows the science and knows that all this global hysteria is,
just that.
Hysteria.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Curry, rumor on the streets is that your email from a few days ago was where you thought you had nothing better to do. You might have something better to do today.
No, I'm my head's a little bit scattered. Getting ready for my daughter's birthday dinner.
Oh.
I can take a 1 hour break.
Oh, good.
With you folks.
I was like, for God's sake, don't make us talk about the weather, because that's going to sound like, I could whistle, so we could do that.
I could look out the window.
There's that. Well, it's kind of funny, because I actually emailed her about doing the show this Sunday, because I realized that Dr. Kuby was an hour long, and I'm like, oh, man, we're going to have a whole hour. I looked out the window, and it was raining, and I said to myself, I should email Dr. Curry, because she knows about weather. Real weather, actually, not the fake stuff we keep talking about. So you had said we could talk about current weather, climate, and COP28, so that's what I called our show, but you could do whatever you want.
Oh, sure. I also want to mention my new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk.
Oh, gosh, yes, please.
Which provides a framework for thinking about this whole thing. But I'm happy to talk about whatever topics you think might be
interesting. Yeah, we should talk. I have a I kind of didn't say that, but it's right here on the page for today. So let's see. Today is December 10th, 2023. And if you go to our webpage, I popped it right on there, and it's got her Twitter thing. Her website is judithcurry.com. And really easy. You don't have a tricky name. It's not spelled weird. Three cheers for your parents. CFANClimate.net. That's her business. And the book is Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. Imagine that. So let's just zoom right to that COP28 beeswax, because, they're not rethinking our response in a way that the rest of us would like.
If we just get rid of the cows, we'll be able to fix everything.
If we get rid of everything, actually, get rid of us, that would be good. But tell people, if COP28 is like, what? If that's a whole new term for them, can you...
This is the COP stands for Conference of the Parties, and this is the parties to the UN Climate Agreement, including the Paris 2015 agreement, which most of the world's countries have signed on to, including the U.S. So every year or two, they have these big confabs. This year's is absolutely huge. I think there's over 100,000 people there. We which is maybe three times the normal size of these conferences, and it's supposed to be for 2 weeks, but it shows no time, no sign of finishing because they really haven't accomplished very much.
Oh, that's a shock.
So there's still a lot of things on their plate. But it's interesting, it's being hosted, you know, in the Middle East, in the middle of oil country.
Yeah, because they're in Dubai, aren't they?
Yes, yes.
Where they all flew on their private planes?
Oh, exactly, exactly. The carbon footprint of this thing is absolutely enormous. So, you know, they go, what? We're supposed to stop using fossil fuels? No, we're not agreeing to that. You know, and so, you know, these are the hosts of the whole thing. And so people, there's all sorts of people there, including lobbyists and oil companies and wind turbine companies and battery turbine companies and activists and scientists. It's just an enormous group of people trying to accomplish what is not entirely clear. But they have these crazy deadlines, you know, about stopping emissions and temperature targets and whatever, that are mostly made up in terms of deadlines are really political targets. And we don't show any sign of really meeting these emission targets. A couple of good things so far have come out. They've agreed that nuclear energy is now a good thing. Okay, it's now considered, I guess, green. So I think maybe 30 countries have signed on to this. And yeah, John Kerry in the U.S., who normally does, you know, very senseless things about climate change, he's been pushing nuclear energy now. I mean, even a year ago, nuclear energy was a no-go.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody.
Right.
We were shutting down the nuclear power plants in the U.S. and in countries in Europe and whatever. And now people realize, well, you know, nuclear is really fine. You know, it's just the Greenpeace-type organizations who hate nuclear along with everything else who, you know, have really pushed this anti-nuclear thing. But nuclear is a really good solution heading in, you know, deeper into the 21st century. So now that the fatwa against nuclear has been lifted, I think that's a really good sign. The other thing they're trying to accomplish, and they're calling it loss and damages. It used to be reparations, where, like, first world countries would reimburse developing world for all the damage that we've caused from fossil fuels. And the U.S. isn't buying it, although the Europeans seem to go along with it, but there's not much support for that. So they're calling it loss and damages. And that's complicated also because you have to attribute, you know, any losses or damages to global warming. So even if it's just weather or crumbling infrastructure or bad governance, you know, we have to blame it on CO2 emissions
in order
to get money from this fund. So that's sort of senseless. And hopefully they'll go back to the old days of maybe 10 years ago when it used to be development and foreign aid. We used to try to help underdeveloped countries develop their economies and, you know, provide some engineering support to improve their infrastructure and reduce their vulnerabilities to extreme weather events. I mean, that's what we used to do in the old days, trying to promote economic development. Now all of that kind of money has been subsumed into climate mitigation, you know, making countries green, even if they don't have any electricity at all.
Right, right. The people are all starving and they're sick and they don't.
Right.
Yeah, they have no future, exactly. But you know what? It's green there. So
right,
that's amazing.
Right. And they regard burning dung and things like that for cooking as green because I guess it's renewable. So, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. So.
Well, just out of curiosity, like, I remember The first I remember about this was like in the 80s with Earth Day. And yes. I remember my kids were little. It had been early 80s. And I lived over on the coast where, you know, insanity reigns supreme. And it was like all about Earth Day. And they were telling the kids, you know, save all your cans and your newspapers, what we used to get back then. Save your newspapers and, you know, then recycle them. We're all going to bring them to school and recycle them. And they had these kids. It was like a cult. And that was a long time ago.
Yeah, it got really big in the 90s.
Yeah, in the 80s, it was kind of big over there because they sort of leaned that way. But I full disclosure, I waited till Earth Day, and then I put my kids in the car, and we loaded all that stuff up, and we went to the dump, and we threw it in the landfill. So I was like, there you go, kids. There's Earth Day for you.
Nice. You were a real activist.
I was a non-player at the outset. I was not destined to be a climate scientist or a true believer. But it's gotten much worse since then, and much more of a... I mean, it's like a religion. It kind of reminds me of religion, because they keep talking about how you have to believe in it.
Well, exactly, you know, and there's calling people deniers and heretics, and there's a dogma, and, you know, it's a secular religion, but it's even encroaching into real religion, the Pope. It's really gung-ho on this. I mean, there's even a papal academy of science, which is mostly focused on climate and environmental science, who advise the Pope, who makes these proclamations. So it's not just secular religion, it's real religion as well. So,
Well, I'm not a scientist, but I don't remember ever taking a course in science in high school or college where I had to believe in things. Science was sort of always about bringing receipts, you know? Here's the proof. I didn't have to believe in it. It was right there in front of my face.
It's about data and, you know, labs and hypotheses and the scientific method and all this sort of thing. And now it's become... You know, some states have really been extremely aggressive about this, where they integrate climate into all aspects of the curriculum, you know, even math. And it's not in a science-y sort of way. It's more the impacts, you know, and it's the dangers of it. So it's, I mean, it's really pretty bad. The NEA in the U.S. and all the teachers, like, I don't have my acronyms right, but they're really activists in terms of pushing a climate curriculum, you know, in the K-12 education, and it's throughout all subjects, you know, really trying to build awareness and create young activists.
Yeah.
My daughter is in eighth grade, and so she told me that, I guess this was her English and literature teacher, telling them, you know, all about Greta Thunberg and how she's making a difference and how important what she is doing, and on it goes. And
yeah, that's...
The teacher was trying to elicit students, well, what can you do? And my granddaughter... who's eminently practical, he says, well, I need to go to school and learn a whole lot more about all this before I figure out what's going on and what kind of difference I might want to make in this regard. You know, so she wasn't going to buy.
So she's like a little heretic in training.
Because
that's not part of the True Believer anthem. Actually, I'm positive it isn't. We have to take a really quick break. But since we're not going to play the COP 23, 4, whatever it is, COP 28 theme song, I thought I would try to find some selections that maybe could be substituted for the COP 28 theme song, just some alternate possibilities we'll be playing this hour. And you are listening to Dr. Judith Curry. She is on with us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars.
Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
The world's spinning round like a loony balloon, heading for a collision with Saturn and Mars. And we're narrowly missing the man in the moon, spinning out of control, crashing into the stars. Have we all lost our gravity, reason and sanity? Is this the price that we pay? Have we all lost our way on this loony balloon?
Yes, apparently we have lost our way on the loony balloon, and a bunch of the loonies on the balloon are in Dubai right now, along with a friend of ours, Debbie Bacigalupi. She's there. I don't think she's dressed like a pig this time, but the one time she went to those conferences, she dressed like a pig and followed Al Gore around the whole time. And she got a lot of satisfaction out of that. She sent me a text this morning that she went up to Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and asked him if he was going to just eat bugs, when he was going to start eating bugs, and he shoved her, actually, and told her to get out of his face. I'm like, oh. Video.
So I'm curious, Dr. Curry. These countries that are participating in COP28, how many of them are actually moving their green energy agenda forward, or are they just giving lip service to it and actually still running coal power plants and realizing that, you know, this whole wind and electric thing just isn't working for them?
Okay, well, there's a few countries that are just blessed with natural resources, lots of hydropower and geothermal. Think Iceland, Norway, Costa Rica, a few countries like that. I mean, they've been almost 100% renewable for a long time. A lot of hydropower in Brazil, as long as they're not in a drought. Mm-hmm. So some countries just have naturally abundant.
Yeah, if your country's sitting on top of a volcano, I guess you got plenty of thermo, but most countries aren't.
Okay. So I think the most interesting case study is Germany, who had a pretty good mix, you know, like maybe 10 years ago. They had a pretty good mix of energy from nuclear, coal, natural gas. And then they wanted to go completely renewable. They went and shut down their nuclear plants and shut down their coal plants and imported natural gas from Russia. We know how that one turned out. And they were building all sorts of wind turbines and solar farms. And their electricity was really expensive. I mean, even with natural gas from Russia, their electricity was really expensive, and industry was, you know, starting to leave, and the power was intermittent. You know, once you get a lot of wind and solar, I mean, the wind doesn't always blow, and then you have to quick rush to make up the missing power with natural gas and fire up more burners and things like that. Okay, and so, of course, when they dropped all their nuclear after Fukushima, they said, okay, nuclear is a bad thing. Let's get rid of nuclear. They had a lot of nuclear power. Okay, and then they, once the natural gas tap was turned off from Russia, then they fired back up their coal power plants using their own coal, which is really dirty. I mean, the coal in the U.S. is actually relatively clean. I think it's the hardest and cleanest in the world. A lot of the coal in Europe is really dirty stuff. So the net result after German energy weaned, whatever they call it, is to be producing more emissions than they used to, largely because they have so much coal and they lost their nuclear and even natural gas. And they're competing, and now they want liquefied natural gas, which is transportable. But then they're competing with all sorts of other countries. Like Pakistan, they were told to go green, and so they, you know, not use coal, so they were relying on natural gas. They don't have pipelines, so they were shipping in liquefied natural gas. Now they have to compete price-wise with countries in Europe who want it, and it's too expensive for the Pakistanis. Okay, and so they're left in a bad place because they got rid of their coal and went natural gas, which they had to import, and now it's too expensive. So all of this has led to more expensive energy for sure, and certainly not cleaner energy because coal is up. You know, the last couple of years, coal burning is really up. So, you know, we're not making progress, and then we've got all these unsightly and environmentally unsound wind turbines and solar farms that produce intermittent electricity. So we're not in a very good place. But even, you know, China is the most, you know, it's because it's so huge and they use so much energy, they've been installing an insane amount of wind and solar power. Insane amount. But then when you look at where their power comes from, it's only 7% from wind and solar, 82% from fossil fuel. You go, well, what the heck's going on? They're installing all this wind and solar plant. Well, the transmission operators aren't using the wind and solar. I mean, it's not dispatchable. You can't call it up when you need it. And it's too complicated to manage their electricity grids with the wind and solar. So they don't often actually use it. They just curtail it. So it's not being used. Wow. You know, so like, you know, like what kind of sense does this make? So the people who have gone wind and solar aren't generally too happy about it. In the U.S., Texas, they get between 20 and 30%. Of their electricity from wind and solar. And it's a real juggling act to balance it. You know, when the wind and solar power aren't available, then they have to try to anticipate it and then make sure they have enough natural gas supply. And then they have to fire up the gas burners and their peak burners. And the management is really horrendously difficult. And the ERCOT, the Texas grid operators and power generators, you know, they're really good, but sometimes it's too much for them. In February of 2021, there was a really big cold spell, and the wind wasn't blowing, the natural gas lines were frozen, and they were, like, in a really big trouble.
Well, I remember that.
And they were within minutes of crashing the whole system, you know, and having to go to a black start, which could take a couple weeks. Part of it was grid operator errors because they weren't, you know, managing, the generation and the transmission and the curtailment and all this kind of stuff. But it's a horrendously challenging thing to do. You know, people are going to make mistakes under that kind of, so they made some suboptimal decisions, but there was no, I mean, there was sort of crisis, but not catastrophe. So it's very difficult to manage. So I can understand why the Chinese just don't want to use it. I mean, it's just going to bring more problems that they, you know, don't want to deal with. I think there's a future for rooftop solar. I think there are some advancements that could be made in that technology, and people tend to like having some local control over their own power generation. So I think rooftop solar is probably a solution that will stick around. But, you know, 20, 30 years from now, I don't think we're going to be using wind turbines for power other than in some niche locations. I mean, it just doesn't make sense given its intermittency, its land use requirements, the need for more extensive transmission lines, and really adverse ecosystem impacts. So farmers don't want the wind turbines on their land.
No.
A, because it dries out the soil and it prevents the soil from cooling down at night. So it changes the microclimate of the farm. You know, they don't, you know, wait a minute. You know, we don't want to deal with this. I mean, and they're worried about, you know, the resale value of their farmland if they have a wind turbine on it. So there's been so many proposals for wind farms that have been just canceled. I think that's over 600 in the U.S. wind farms that have just been canceled because of sort of not in my backyard kind of concerns, environmentalist concerns. And this isn't to mention all the ones waiting in the queue where the transmission grid operators can't really integrate it at this point. You know, they need, you know, it just can't easily be integrated. So it's sort of in the
queue.
Part
of it is it's not a dependable source. I mean, I would imagine that it just fluctuates up and down, which makes it very difficult to manage.
Absolutely. And it's not only is it intermittent, but it's asynchronous. This is a little bit of an engineering term. But you have to keep, you know, like inertia. You know, you have to keep the frequency. You just have to keep it moving. You just can't have things stop. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So it has, yeah. So it's just that the need for, like, inertia in the power system, and it adds so much asynchronicity to it. It really makes it very difficult. So it's, in addition to intermittency, you have this asynchronicity issue where it makes frequency control very difficult. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's not 21st century technology. Why are we doing this? Well, the reason we're doing it is because all of these urgencies, the deadlines, the code reds, highway to hell, and all this crazy rhetoric that you hear, we have to hurry up and do something. And, you know, the cheapest, fastest thing to do is put up wind turbines and solar farms. But, you know, it's not a good solution. You know, it's really a step backwards. And it's really not helping on balance reduce CO2 emissions, because you have to back it up by natural gas. And when you're firing up and down these natural gas power plants, you know, they're less efficient. You know, and ramping it up and ramping it down, you're not really saving, you know, preventing any CO2 emissions here, because you have to ramp up and down these gas power plants. Not only does it produce more emissions, it also produces wear and tear on the power plants. So they, you know, they have to be replaced more frequently. And the blades on the wind turbines, after 10 years, they stop producing as much energy. So
they do?
They last 20, 25 years. Well, physically, yeah. But the degradation and the power that's produced really starts degrading after 10 years.
They get so, like, dull from chopping up all the birds? Is that what's happening?
sort of. But they just don't work as well, or produce as much energy by quite a bit. And each year it drops down. And, you know, it has to be factored in to figuring out how much power you're getting from your wind turbine. But people are saying, we really need to replace these every 10 to 15 years. You know, these huge turbines. If you've ever driven down a highway behind a truck that's carrying, like, some of these blades for wind turbines, they're insanely, they're absolutely huge. You don't realize it when you look up at them, because they're really high up, you know, like several hundred feet up. You don't really realize how big those turbine blades are. But when you see a truck carrying them, I mean, I was just astonished when I saw it.
No, we had a big wind farm here locally that was put in a few years back, and I saw those trucks, and, I mean, they require highway closures and flaggers and everything else, and in a lot of the locations around here, you don't have, like, straight highways. You have mountain roads where you're trying to get these blades up in the hills, and they are huge. You know, negotiating the roads just to transport those, that's a big problem. But, you know, solar has its issues as well. I mean, aside from the fact that the more solar they put up, the more expensive conventional energy is, because everybody that's still on the grid has to make up the difference in the amount of money that's the power companies aren't earning because customers are on solar. But solar, you know, is, unless you put in huge battery backups, when the power goes out, you don't have any power with solar. You have to put in these big battery banks to maintain your power. So, I mean, that technology is not all there either.
Okay, well, the business model for electric utilities needs to be changed to accommodate solar in a sensible way.
Mm-hmm.
So the existing model doesn't work very well, and there's all sorts of conflicts, and I know there is in California for sure. The issue, I have solar panels on my house, and I have two Tesla power walls, and the price on those are coming down. So I think this is like a viable strategy. I mean, the bug, you know, it's still too expensive, and the electric utilities don't really have the right business model and the right pricing model. But I think those are things that can be overcome. So I still think that technology remains useful. I do it not for CO2 emissions, but just so I have energy security. So if
what a clever idea, huh? That's what we should be doing all of this for. I mean, that ought to be the goal,
exactly.
Right?
Well, you could do a propane tank. You know, the alternatives are
tank
or the wind and solar and batteries.
But just doing it all by itself is just, it's just not feasible for, like, cities and towns and, all right, we have to take a really quick break. Sorry, I was just going on a rant. I was going to go on a rant.
Hold the rant.
Found another song for COP28. Okay, that might be the theme song. I think I found it.
You lie to me. Yeah, there you go.
It's got a snazzy beat. I could see them all dancing up there in their fancy outfits. Honestly, you haven't lived until you've gone to the little, just do a little, I'll post it, the little search for the COP28 website, and their little song's right there on the front page. It is really, I can't get it out of my mind. I saw it last night before I went to bed. It was not probably my smartest idea. Freak show. So what?
Say what you mean.
Yes, yeah. Freak show. So Dr. Curry, honestly, with all of this stuff, you do consulting work, you write books, you've been a professor for a long time. We're not changing the weather, are we? Like, not to put too fine a point on it, but like,
well,
you know.
Okay.
With the technology we have currently, can we change the weather?
No. Humans do impact the climate. The CO2 emissions do have a tiny warming effect, but, you know, that doesn't really translate into bad weather. People's land use and the urban heat islands and all this kind of stuff, that does modify their local climate and their local weather. It may, you know, rainfall may be heavier downstream of a city or something like that. So there are some, you know, impacts that we have on weather. We certainly can't control the weather or climate, but the weather, you know, is is global ocean and atmospheric circulations, which we really have a minuscule impact on. So even, you know, people have been, we had a spike in global temperature this year. In February, it started warming, and by the end of May, it was really quite warm in the global oceans. And they stayed warm all summer and into the fall, and they seem to be coming back down a little bit. People think, oh my gosh, this is what the climate models have been predicting. Well, you know, I did an analysis of all the satellite data, the top of the atmosphere radiation balance, the energy balances at the surface winds. I did a big analysis of all this. And what was going on in 2023 was a lack of clouds. The cloudiness was really reduced in the northern hemisphere oceans, and the wind speeds were reduced also. And this was just sort of a fluke combination of circulation patterns, you know, that gave us that. And so with less cloudiness, more of the sunlight could get in and be absorbed by the Earth system. And the wind speeds were low, and that kept the ocean evaporation to a minimum and allowed the ocean surface to heat up. And that's what we saw in the northern hemisphere, you know, during last summer. And, you know, the combination of a number of things, we just came off three La Nina events, and we're starting an El Nino event. We had an unusual circulation pattern in the Atlantic. You know, so it was really natural climate variability that was producing all this. And actually the sign, and it had nothing to do with the CO2 emissions, because the sign of the radiation trend, the anomaly at the top of the atmosphere, is exactly the opposite of what you would expect from increasing CO2. It was really, you know, reflecting the signature from the clouds. So, I mean, that's a little bit technical, but the bottom line is this, all this record warming and whatever this year, it has really nothing to do with carbon dioxide. So, I mean, there's a lot of natural weather and climate variability that happens. The other thing that we're feeling, you know, a couple of years ago, there was the Hunga Tonga volcano. You may have heard about it. It was an underwater volcano that erupted, and it blew a lot of water vapor up into the stratosphere that has been circulating its way around. In the summer, you could really see the effects in the Antarctic in the southern hemisphere, their winter, and the water vapor has made it now to the northern polar regions in the stratosphere, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, but that is definitely having an effect.
And that's nothing that we have any control over.
No, we have absolutely nothing to do with it. So it's a combination of Hunga Tonga volcano and the ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns. And we're also heading towards the solar, you know, the 11-year solar maximum. So that gives it a little bit of a boost. So this is natural. It had nothing to do with the slow creep of increasing CO2. So, you know, against the very large natural weather and climate variability, it's very hard to, you know, discern any kind of a signal from the CO2 increase. I mean, that's really just the slow creep, you know, slowly increasing sea level rise, slowly receding glaciers, that kind of thing. You know, it's not, you know, affecting the weather. You know, this year in the U.S., apart, you know, all these crazy stories about record high temperatures, but it's really been a very benign year for the U.S. There was only one landfalling hurricane that did not very much damage in Florida. That was Hurricane Idalia. There's been hardly any forest fires in California. I mean, the only big insurance claims have come from thunderstorm-type weather and some tornadoes. I mean, that's been the main, you know, insurance claims from bad weather in the U.S. this year. So in spite of these really warm temperatures, it wasn't you know, a bad weather year for the U.S. at all. So, you know, there's just
So much for the hysteria. Well, swinging back to this idiotic deal in Dubai, is this just an excuse for a bunch of people to prance around and virtue signal, or do they really think they're getting something done?
Well, people are trying to get an angle. I mean, there's companies there trying to cut deals. There's people there trying to influence policy. You know, people trying to make a buck, trying to have influence. You know, it's not this big meeting of altruistic, wise people or whatever.
No,
you know,
just look at the cast of characters
for
that.
And power, you know. And there's a lot of sort of science-y. I know a number of scientists who've gone. You know, I see them talking on Twitter. Oh, I went to COP28. They're completely irrelevant at this point. You know, nobody's listening to the scientists. You know, that this has all developed a life of its own. And, you know, the last thing any of these people want to do is listen to some scientist. So,
says the scientist.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to listen to some scientist.
Yeah, so it's just a big confab. Huge number of people. I mean, just a huge number of people there.
Do they, how much, I know this isn't something that you can really exactly put a number on, but like, how much of an influence does that stuff really have?
I mean, at the end of the day, the UN is powerless. It only gets its power from, you know, national governments. And at the end of the day, I mean, you know, you've seen this is COP28. It means there have been 27 of these before them, and emissions still keep going up. I mean, and the only thing that we've done is slow down development of countries in Africa and, you know, put up a bunch of wind turbines and all that that aren't really reducing emissions on balance. So there's not very much that's been accomplished at the end of the day.
Why do they keep having them? I mean, I'm asking you things you can't really answer. You know, I mean, I can't figure out why they keep having it. It's just because they all like going to these exotic places and looking like they're doing something, and then there's all the shoulder rubbing and the graft and all the rest of it. Is that just the whole? It's a wonderful excuse to do all that? Because that's what it looks like.
No, but people want to have a seat at the table, you know, if there's something big going on. So people, you know, like Trump, you know, took us out of the Paris Agreement. And then, of course, first thing Biden did was get us back in. it'd be interesting if Trump gets elected again. We will see this happen again. But it's fairly meaningless either way. The U.S. has done much better than most countries in terms of reducing emissions, largely because we've replaced a lot of coal burning with natural gas. I mean, that's the single most significant thing that we've done. At the end of the day, the wind and solar aren't doing much on balance. So, you know, it's just, I mean, it really makes no sense. I mean, when we, you know, in the year 2100, when we're all doing really fine and the world will be much wealthier and healthier than it is now, and we look back on this period, you know, people will wonder, what the heck were they thinking?
yeah, hopefully they'll open the time capsule and just mock all of this stuff. They'll use it for comedy.
Well, there's always so much revisionist history that goes on. It'll be interesting to see how this gets whitewashed.
Then there's that.
Or greenwashed or whatever they do to it.
Well, I mean, even when you look at their, like, okay, here's just their little statement on their website's hilarious. It's cop28.com, so it's pretty easy for people to find, but It says, the UAE is a global hub and growth engine for sustainability, technology, business, commerce, and tourism. The country is uniquely positioned to build bridges and foster consensus to accelerate inclusive climate progress. I'm sorry. Did that say anything?
No, it doesn't say anything. Oh, but of course. Oh, you mean we're supposed to, you know, get rid of oil and gas? No way.
But they don't say any of that. I mean, it's just this, la 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 la. We're going to foster consensus to accelerate inclusive climate progress. What is foster consensus to accelerate inclusive climate? What's an inclusive climate progress? You're a climate scientist. Well, is that a thing?
It's a bunch of word salad, but they made it very clear that they're not interested in restricting fossil fuel production. So if you can control the methane problem, natural gas is certainly better than coal. Oil, there's so many uses for oil. We'll be using oil probably forever. We probably won't be burning it for fuel much past the 21st century, because I think it's too valuable just to burn it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are better ways to proceed. You know, we should be taking a step back. The thing we should be, the real tragedy of all this is energy and climate policy got coupled. Energy policy is so much more complex. You know, there are so many other factors at play, and like the environment is only one of the factors. And we should be stepping back and envision what we want our 21st energy infrastructure to look like. Yeah, sure, we want it to be clean, abundant, and cheap. You know, how do we get there? Well, nuclear is an obvious one, and we want to minimize land use and resource use overall. Again, a nuclear score is very high there. I mean, so we should just be stepping back and try to figure out, you know, what would we like this to look like, and then how do we get there? And we're going to need a lot of fossil fuels to get us there. We're going to make a transition, you know, to a better 21st century infrastructure, and trying to kneecap fossil fuels before we have anything to replace it with is just a recipe for economic and national security disaster.
Yeah, it's total lunacy. You can't just dump it without a plan. I mean, we have a lot of ideas, but we don't have a plan. You're absolutely right.
Well, they come up with all this stuff and all this happy talk. You know, they're going to reform land use, transform food systems. They're going to mobilize solutions for vulnerable countries, operationalize loss and damage, and deliver the most inclusive conference possible.
Okay, well, we need to talk about food. When you talk about climate change, you tend to talk about how it's
doing. Dr. Curry, you get to talk about food because you're going to plan a party. And I hate to say this, but we're getting cut off by the news.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to have to do this again on a different day, and we will be in touch with you. And thanks for helping us kneecap the ridiculous climate. Lunacy.
Okay. Thanks. This was fun.
It was super fun. And thanks for coming on with us again. You can find all this at
WeThePeopleRadio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back, though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.